thank you so much. My name is Cass, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. And I'm proud to say, although it didn't have an awful lot to do with me, I've been sober since May 25th, 1985. And for that, I will be forever grateful. And wow, thanks, Annie. That was great. And Chrissy, that's incredible. I'm still trying to do half of what you had written on your paper. I'm like, yeah, one day. I'm working on it, though. You know, that's the thing. Don't drink. Keep working on it. But I am sponsored by Carlene Elm. She's in Helena, Montana. It took me a while to catch her and find her and whatever. And so I'm not going to give her up, even though I moved to Florida not all that long ago. And we talk all the time. And I just love her. I love her. I'm crazy about her. And she even acts like she's crazy about me. And that's very attractive. I get to sponsor people today. I'm really, really honored that anyone sees something that they want when they see me. It's really not why I got here. You know, it's not how I got here either. But how I did get here was I didn't come from a family like some people have shared in Annie tonight. My family, as far back as I know, drinking was a family business. And my dad was from an Irish heritage. He wore his partying, drinking, you know, credentials like a badge of honor. And nobody ever drank him under the table and all that. And my mother was a little German lady from that background, and she was very punctual and responsible. And my dad was an Irish crazy person who didn't know what a schedule was. And so my house was nutty when I was growing up, and my mom was constantly trying to control my dad's drinking. My dad was constantly trying to get out from under any control. And but they loved each other. That was the good part about all that. And I think both me and my brother, the two children, I think we're both alcoholic, although as far as I know, my brother never did or has tried to stay sober, although I know he's been exposed to AA. And I didn't know anything about this program for when I was out there drinking. I was just having a good time. I was having a very good time. And if you try to tell me that, correct me, I did not like talking to you about my drinking. And if you wanted to do that, then we were not friends any longer. I needed to get moving along, you know, time to move along. And so being where I grew up was very rural. And so my opportunities for a budding alcoholic were very limited. So I was back in the boonies in Virginia, and my parents moved there, I realized, because then they could drink, not have the neighbors, you know, looking in and stuff. And so I got away from there as quickly as I could and joined the Navy. That was my ticket out of the rural Virginia scene. And because I, you know, the recruiter knew exactly what to say. I don't know if he knew this or not. But he said the drinking age was 18 on base. And most of the time, the women's barracks was right next to the bar, the enlisted men's club. And that sounded very convenient for me. I'm sure other people thought it was convenient, too, but not for the reasons I thought. And so in Virginia at that time, the drinking age was 21. Well, I was already struggling, being the budding alcoholic that I was. And so I was unemployed, of course. I wasn't much for working. I don't know about you guys, but it interfered with my drinking. You know, it took time, and they wanted to be there on time and look decent and stuff. It was very, you know, well, I don't know what I was thinking when joining the Navy on that account, you know. They do a lot more than expect you to be there on time looking good. They, you know, they want you to look spick and span, and I did my best. What can I say? And they can't really, like, fire you, so that was a good thing. But and this is how I looked at it too. It was like all the drinking I could do. It was like all the men, as far as you could see, there were sailors, you know, and they were lonely and away from home and their girlfriends and or wives, whatever. And I was there. That's what they thought too. This is very convenient, you know. There is a enlisted men's club right next to the women's barracks, and the enlisted men club was full of men. That was pretty cool. And you know, most of the time I could get from the bar back to the barracks, most of the time, and because it was walking distance or, you know, stumbling distance, whatever. And most of the guys, I have to tell you, most of the guys were very gentlemanly and made sure that us ladies got to the barracks and stuff, because nobody wanted to be responsible for anyone being, you know, tardy, we'll say, and things like that. But I had an awful lot of fun in the Navy. I drank as much as I could, believe me. I did my best, which was a pretty good job. And I traveled a lot and got to see, I don't know, the whole world was not possible, but as much as I could fit in. And I got married twice, and the first guy really just didn't know what hit him. I really, you know, he was in the Navy, I was in the Navy, we seemed to drink a lot alike. And then he took me home as his wife, and he was very surprised that I still wanted to drink like I did before we got married. I said, well, of course, you know. So it was not a match made in heaven, as I had first, you know, thought. So he learned the truth and made a better choice about his living arrangements and things. So that was my first divorce. And then I met the next guy, who was also a sailor. Imagine that. And you guys that, or people that know about the Navy, he was a torpedo man. And so his drinking fit me very much better. And my drinking did not shock him at all. We got along fine on that account. And so I made it out of the Navy, and we moved to New England. And we in the Navy, I was moving around a lot. And he was still in the Navy, my ex-husband, that was then my present, current husband. And we moved to New England, and it would really seem like a match made in heaven, because even though he worked on a sub-tender and had a top-secret clearance and worked with nuclear subs and things, he and his chief would run drugs across the Canadian border on the weekends when they didn't have duty. And so I had my drug dealer was right in the same house with me. It was very convenient, you know. It was like, woohoo, you know, I've hit the jackpot this time, you know. But you know how we are. We think we've found the solution. But this guy, you know, he was a little rough around the edges. And after a while, I realized that he was a violent guy. And, you know, I might have had a clue to this, because when we started drinking and dating and drinking and dating and stuff before we got married and stuff, he would tell me things that I should have caught on to, but I thought he was just interrupting the moment. You know, you know how men do that. They just kind of bring up unrelated topics, you know. But he looked at me really serious one night with love in his eyes, you know, and he was like holding my face or something tender, and he's like looking me in the eyes, and he go, "I would never hit you." I was, well, of course not. Fill up that glass again. Come on, you're putting the buzzkill on, you know. So, you know, but I should have caught the drift, you know. And after we got married, of course, one thing led to another, and there was violence and other things going on. So I left that marriage, and I was out of the Navy by then. But I wasn't done with my drinking career. I was just a youngster, you know. And my brother, my other drinking buddy, invited me to come to California. So I'm doing geographics. I'm moving from the northern border to the southern border, from the eastern border to the western coast. And so I go to California because that's going to be the solution to my life of, you know, not finding the right him, because there was always him. You got to find him. And that was going to fix me and things. And it just, you know, my drinking would bother my friends and sometimes my family. But my family, I told you, runs in my family, this alcoholism, so they couldn't understand why I wasn't doing as well as some other people who could. You know those people that, some of you were out here tonight, you drink all night, and then you get up, and no matter what you've been doing the night before, you get your butt to work in the morning. I mean, you tough it out and everything. I always envied that. I never could get that through, you know, figure that part out. So I would try to find him. Maybe he could get to work and, you know, take care of me. So I moved to the West Coast, and I met the man I spent the most time with. And he wanted to get married, but I learned my lesson, and I'm like, no, we're not getting married. But I was with him for several years, and I affectionately refer to him as the axe murderer. It's just an affectionate name because he didn't use an axe. Shotgun was what he used, and it was his sister that he murdered, but he made it look like a suicide, so... no one knew, you know, and so we, you know, we're living together, we're, you know, he thinks that we're engaged, and he would bring up things like, if you really knew some of the things I've done, you might not be so, you know, fuzzy, warm and fuzzy with me. I'm like, what do you mean? Did you rob a bank? You know, did you commit a crime of some? It never occurred to me that he would actually be a murderer. And believe me, I don't know if that would have mattered, but I didn't think of it. I just want to tell you that. And so, you know, time is passing, and I'm just, you know, I'm losing this job. I'm walking out of that job just before they fire me. I'm trying to go, you know, I'm going to therapy. I go to Sunday school. I go to church. I go to therapy again, you know, And I read all the self-help books because I don't know what's wrong with me. I just know that I cannot live like you people. I cannot hold a job. I cannot pay my bills on time. I can't get up in the morning on time. I just can't, you know, I can't keep my if I have a car, I can't keep it fixed. My car would break down and it would sit on the street until I could save up some money to get it fixed. And even after I got sober, how long was I sober? A few months at least, because all that is rather fuzzy, but I got stopped for no registration and no insurance, which is a big deal in California at the time. And so, I just had trouble with everything. Anything that you could do to live a life, I just struggled with terribly. And so I finally realized that I had to get rid of the axe murderer, but... because we weren't getting along, and he kept pressing me to get married and things, and he was just too weird. So I find out later what he did. But I just can't live. I can't live. I can't drink enough to live my life. I can't stay sober enough to live my life. I just can't do either one. So I find myself in an AA meeting. Now, I had heard about AA a year or so before. I had a friend of a friend of a friend that told me that they got sober, and I thought, well, that's very nice for you. I'm glad to hear this about you. I heard that you were a terrible person, and now you're not, so that's really been a good thing for you. Congratulations. I'm leaving now. You know, I didn't want to hear anything more about it, and so I knew about AA, and so when I wanted to kill myself all the time because I couldn't stand the pain anymore, of not being able to stay drunk and not being able to get sober, I walked into an AA meeting one night, and it was a women's meeting, and I was in so much pain. I sat there, you know what happened. It was a women's meeting. The women swarm around me. I don't know how they knew I was new, but they came and said, hey, let's get you a cup of coffee. Come on in, sit down. I just started bawling. I cried the entire meeting. That's all I remember. And I remember women supporting me and saying, you know what, it's going to be all right. You are going to be all right now. And when they started doing the introductions, I heard everybody saying, you know, my name is, and I'm an alcoholic. And it, you know, like the light bulb went off, you know. And when it came to me, I'm not going to stick out. I'm going to do whatever you're doing. So I said, you know what, my name is Cass. I'm an alcoholic. You know, and started crying and stuff. And they were very impressed, of course, you know, and went on with the meeting, you know, of course. And so I've been here ever since. And I have to tell you, I have such an amazing life today, like Annie and Chrissy were talking about. I'm no exception. You know, this program works for everyone, no matter who you are, what situation you're in. There's no one here that cannot stay sober if they really want to. And you got to really have nothing left. I came here with a wonderful gift of desperation. There was nothing left to use. There was no one left to use. There was no situation I could manipulate to my benefit. There was just nothing left. Nobody wanted to help me. And I was desperate. And that was a wonderful gift. I didn't know it at the time. I thought it was pretty bad. And I thought I was pretty lame. Here I am, an alcoholic. Why can't I have a cool disease? Like, you know, cancer, something, you know. Especially if it was terminal, then people really feel sorry for me. Oh, you poor thing, you know. No, I have to have alcoholism. Oh, great, you know. So I was not thrilled with the news, but I didn't know what else to do. And I would come to meetings, and after a few minutes or a few months, a few weeks, whatever it was, you know, people started approaching me and saying, listen, we get here early and set up. We need help. Why don't you come? Just be here early, a few minutes. We got chairs, coffee, whatever. And they were just very sweet and wonderful. You know how we are. And, you know, newcomers, don't forget how you were welcomed. And do this yourself. Take it upon yourself when you have some time, like Chrissy. It's your turn. Welcome the newcomer. Because they don't have a clue. They're clueless. Newcomers don't know what we do here. And someone was kind and said, you know what, we get here early and we set up and we stay after the meeting and see what needs to be done. And I didn't know, because I was getting out there at the last second and leaving before the prayer, amen, happened, you know, out the door. And so I started realizing that I belonged here, and I found a sponsor, and I tried to do the steps to the best of my ability. You don't have to do them perfect. You just have to do them. And it's really a wonderful thing. As time passed, I got more involved in service, and, you know, I have some time, and I don't know why this impresses some people. It doesn't really impress me. It's just what I need to do. But I need to do everything today that I did in the beginning. So you guys that feel like you have some time now and you can rest on your laurels or go, well, you know, let's let the newcomers do some of this stuff. Well, you go right ahead, but you be right there with them. You be right there with them because, you know, I'm going to jails and doing meetings. You know, I'm sponsoring people. I am taking people to meetings. I'm doing everything today I ever did when I was new. And this is the secret. You know, it seems like you should be able to let the other people, you know, do this service work and stuff, but you're missing out. You're missing out if you're not doing everything that you can possibly do right now. And I just want to encourage you. I hope this sounds encouraging. Because instead of fussing, I know what I can sound like. But I met my sweet husband. He's sitting here on the front row cheering me on and being a great guy like he is. He's been a great husband and a wonderful father. And I met him in a room like this. And we were dating. And one night, you know, I realized I needed to talk to him about something. We had not dated all that long, but I was really crazy about this guy, which I knew he was probably very sick. If I was really crazy about him, I try not to tell him that, but this is what I said. I said, listen, I got something to say to you. I had some sobriety here. I think I had 4 or 5 years when we met. And he seemed pretty sober. But I didn't know about his program. I didn't know what was going on with him. And he needed to know what was going on with me. And I said, listen, I try to live this program in my life every day. I pray. I have a relationship with God. I go to meetings. I do service. I have a sponsor. I do all these things. And if this is not okay with you, we need to know now, because I'm starting to get really attached to you. And I'd rather just not go out with you anymore. You know, and then we were... He was driving the car. We were going somewhere, you know, and it got really quiet. And I thought, oh, I've really blown it. You know, this is it. He's going to take me home, and, you know, that's it. And so after making me wait, you know, 3 seconds. I don't know how long it was, but it seemed like forever, you know. He goes, I have been wanting to talk to you about this too, and I agree with you, and I am so glad you said all those things. And it was like, whew, you know, okay, we got past that, you know. And I'll tell you, a marriage between any two people, I don't know how so many happen. It is the hardest thing, or one of the hardest things I've ever done, is stay married to this really cool guy right here. Because, you know, and you guys that are married, you know that's true. You know, it's really hard to keep a marriage together. But sharing our program has really helped a lot. And we do share a program every day. And he still goes to meetings. There was years when he didn't go to very many meetings. And he didn't have a sponsor. And things didn't look very good for him. I can tell on you now because you can't do anything about it. But most of the time, I had a sponsor. I went to meetings really regularly, you know, because I needed that support. I wasn't going to give up on it. But he was trying to be a good husband, and he started going to school full-time and working full-time and doing an awful lot of stuff full-time, but not so much his program. And he stayed sober. I used to tease him that I was his sponsor. And, you know, it's really tough. Don't do it if you can get out of it. Don't let somebody, your spouse, make you their sponsor, because it's a tough job. And I used to embarrass his sponsor that he has now. I used to embarrass him all the time and go, I love you. I'm so glad you're here for Wayne. You know, and he'd be going, you know, slinking down and stuff. But you guys that don't have sponsors, you'll know what I mean. Anyway, I just want to tell you how wonderful my life has been since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's nothing that life can throw at you that you can't handle, not with this program and with the people and the friends that you meet here. And I just thank you so much that you've asked me to speak tonight and that I have a story to share with you. Thanks.
How you guys doing? I'm Jimmy Mack. I'm an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results of proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I've been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to our scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into these words, love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's not bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.